Hello and welcome to Purgatory. Today we have got a very, very, very special guest who gave some very, very, very kind words when I had made the pilot for the show about a year ago, and he is Tom Crowley. Welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Francis.
Oh, thank you for being here. It is very much appreciated. So a lot of people already have heard of you, but for those who haven't, can you just give a little bit about yourself, a bit of background, what you've done and what you're currently doing?
Well, you flatter me, Francis. Thank you. well, for everyone listening who has no idea who I am, my name's Tom Crowley. I'm probably best known in the sort of digital audio world as being playing Eric Chapman and being a series writer on the podcast sitcom Wooden Overcoats. Which is quite an early example of a podcast sitcom. Like, there were others around, but not many in the UK, and I think maybe none that were fully released in the UK before we came along, but that's probably how I'm best known on the internet. Other than that, I've been part of the comedy sketch group Sad Faces, who performed at Edinburgh, and we had a show years ago on Radio 4 Extra, back when Radio 4 Extra shows were commissioned, years and years and years ago. And what else do I do? I'm a writer and performer, and mostly working in comedy, but in sort of related areas of drama and stuff as well. Oh, I'm also in, you might have heard me in the Beef and Dairy Network podcast, kind of performing and co-devising with the creator Ben Partridge. And also I'm one of the lead actors in Victoriosity, which would be my preferential plug, actually, if you haven't heard it. It's a fantastic sort of genre. It's not steampunk. They're keen to point that out because the technology doesn't run on steam. But it's a kind of alternate past Victorian London that has a kind of super advanced strand of technology in a kind of an alternate history way. And I play a detective who, in the very first series, is an ordinary plodding detective who has to solve a murder. And it's just incredibly funny, Douglas Adams-esque, Terry Pratchett-esque writing by Jen and Chris Sugden, a married couple who are nice and my friends and very good writers. And that's a fantastic show. And I suppose the other thing I'd probably be talking about most today is that I produce a one-man sketch comedy podcast wherein I write and perform and edit and compose nearly everything, called Crowley Time, which you should definitely listen to if you enjoy anything about listening to me on this episode.
I was recently listening to it before we spoke, and there was a joke which is absolutely my type of humor.
Oh yeah.
In which the sort of the sillier the better. And it was, and then kind of the voicemail bit where it was somebody going, I'm happy, and then you just scream. It got me a lot.
Yeah, it's nice. The answer machine bits are sort of there. They used to be there just to sort of break up the rhythm of the sketches, but then I started adding bits of script for myself as host to just thread between the sketches as well. So now they're a sort of weird overhang, but I like them because I heard on a different podcast about comedy, because there's enough of them, a rule of three. I heard, I think it was John Finnemore talking about On the Hour, the radio version of the day-to-day, saying that if you have a strong container that is the shape of which is very clear and defined and firm, then you can fill it with as much nonsense as you want. And I think that's a really simple example of, like, you know, just having a sort of answer machine, you know, outgoing message saying, like, oh, this is Crowley Time with me, Tom Crowley. I can't take your call, leave your message. Then whatever follows, you know the context for it. It's someone has rung, you know, inverted commas, the show. Mm. And so then it can just be someone screaming and, you know, that could be funny. But
absolutely. And I think sometimes those jokes where the premise, yeah, doesn't have to be really elaborately complicated.
Yeah.
And then you can go in directions which don't necessarily have to work with like any form of sense. I mean, like another favorite joke I have just in general is one that where if you say the punchline, it makes absolutely no sense.
Right.
But if you say to somebody who knows about the context of the joke, it's absolutely like an episode of Two of My Show where one of the characters says Picasso's a bell end.
Yeah,
And in the context, it's about they're in an art gallery and this guy's being a bit of a troublemaker, and someone's basically saying every time he does something stupid, I call him out on it, and they're sort of, it's their guys to sort of basically flirt and make excuses for it. And then he says in the distance, Picasso's a bell end. But then having that on a t-shirt or a coffee mug.
Well, to see that, I might argue with you there, because I think that when, you know, you have a building following, yes, it's entirely possible that the more oblique, the less likely a stranger is to get the joke, the more it's likely to be, you know, in the world of podcasting. If I wore a Absolutely. T-shirt that said, "Hey, Nong Man," you know, if you knew what that meant, you would think you just found like a brother out in the world, you know, like
like a band beloved t-shirts. Friend.
Exactly, yeah. And like, but if you didn't know what that meant, you would, your mind would not even register it. It would just skip over the nonsensical slogan.
And I think there is thing I've been finding, which is there is so much more of like a close connection people have to kind of fiction podcast.
Yes.
And in comparison to any other media, like web series or YouTube or TV, where there's a much stronger connection. They feel much more closeness with what they're listening to, because you're kind of inside their ear, and it kind of creates this really nice community of people that, you know, other shows obviously can do, but I think there's more of a, I don't know how to explain it, there seems to just be more of a, I don't know, the best explanation probably is just a better sort of connection with what you're participating in.
I think there are a few things going on there. I think it's that when you, I think it's partly because fiction podcasts are, they're very much the exception, because they're difficult to make and sometimes expensive if you're paying people. And,
absolutely.
You know, suddenly
yeah.
costs, if
That's
you're paying
why
people,
I don't
the costs
it.
Suddenly skyrocket. You know? Yeah. And so it's very, and it, you know, it involves planning a series, having a cast of characters, being fairly sure you can keep the same actors so people recognize who they are, writing multiple scripts, recording them. You need sound effects, music, you know, for it to sound right. And it's just a lot more effort. And so when people go, "Oh, we've got a new podcast called The Banter Wagon. It's just me and my friends talking rubbish for half an hour every week." I kind of go, "Oh, how appallingly derivative." On the other hand, I go, "Well, well done, mate, because that's infinitely repeatable. And you'll probably have like Acast sponsorship and merchandise with slogans like Picasso's a bell end,
you know,
out within Patent the month.
Pending.
Yeah, quite indeed. Sorry, I take that back. Don't want to get sued. But I think there's something to it, and I think part of that is that, well, firstly, a really interesting thing to see, sort of from inside of like audio drama podcasting, is that Americans had no concept of like scripted radio drama before podcasts came along. That's not quite true. There was no, like, not since the golden age of radio, of like the Jack Benny Show and The Shadow.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know,
yeah.
The old sort of, you know, best documented in that episode of Frasier, where he has to, you know, make use a wobble board to make thunder, and, you know, there's someone doing gunshot sound effects with a starter pistol, you know, all that. That was sort of the heyday of American radio drama. And like, meanwhile, obviously, like, for the enthusiasts, it never went away. And, like, I mean, there were definitely pockets of people still making audio drama in the States throughout that time. But, you know, they would have been paying attention to stuff like what was coming out of BBC, you know, Radio 4 and 3, drama and comedy, 1 and 2 as well at times. And meanwhile, over here, we're saturated in it. We're exposed to it all the time, like radio drama. And so for all of that inspiration and for all of that kind of tradition to suddenly just be vomited onto the internet, I think was a bit of a kind of genuine moment of revelation for a lot of American people, particularly young American people who
definitely,
you know, would have no interest in listening to, I'm generalizing, but, you know, would probably be less excited about digging up a big collection of, you know, The Many Lives of Harry Lyme. Do you know what I mean? Like, something that's all a bit old-fashioned.
Try and understand The Goon Show or
absolutely.
That again.
Well, listen, I was a young person understanding The Goon Show, and I took to it very well.
Oh, no, ditto. I got off on eBay a CD ROM of all like 168 episodes.
No.
It was amazing.
Oh, my God, that's incredible.
Some guy had archived literally every single episode. He must have either recorded it on X. Some of the recordings weren't good at all.
It's insane when you think about it. We have every single episode of The Goon Show, and we don't have like whole seasons of Doctor Who. It's insane. What happened? Like,
do you know what? I was trying to find the one that traumatized me as a kid. Do you ever remember the 1980s, The Green Death in the mines?
Oh, no, I haven't seen it, but I know of it. Yeah, the story.
And it was something I shouldn't. I think there should be like a cutoff period for watching Doctor Who period, that like Doctor Who episodes where the magic is definitely gone,
right?
And the suspension of disbelief, because I rewatched it and I started to yell existentially at my younger self for being so traumatized by something that had like a 30 pence budget.
I think there's sort of something quite magical about that, though, because I think that it does, like, it's very funny. Is this a boring story? No, fine. I was just going to say, like, I was listening to another podcast. This whole show is just about podcasts. People who only listen to podcasts, people who only make podcasts. It's a podcast-centric okay. show. But I was listening to a deep dive thing about the Alien films, and somebody talked about like how, you know, oh, the effects are mostly really good, but there is that one bit where, I think it's talking about the first Alien, is that there is that one bit where you can see Ian Holmes, like, severed head, spoilers, you know, being put on a table and it looks really, you know, rubbery. And it's like, oh, it's a shame because all the other effects are really good. It's a shame there's that one bit missing. And I did sort of think, yeah, but, you know, it's because they had to really do it.
You know, yeah, exactly.
So surely you make some allowances, you know, where you go, well, this is a pre-CGI time. I don't know. I think there's something special about trying to do something with nothing.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look at like shot by shot comparison of one of my favorites, The Thing, because you know the practical effects were just, I mean, they were, you know, terrifying at the time, but they're beautiful now. And they did a CGI remake, and it just didn't work. And I think the really silly thing was they did practical effects in the remake, and then they just went, "Oh, we'll just do CGI instead." And
Mix, isn't it? Or at least partly. But there is a lot of CGI tentacle work going on.
And we'd learned from The Mist. We should have learned from The Mist.
I quite like The Mist. I mean, it's not a good thing by any stretch, but yeah. No, it's funny. I think I have a theory about The Thing at 1982 and The Thing 2011, which is that they made a really weird decision with the Thing prequel, remake, reboot, prequel, equal, whatever it's called, where, like, so in The Thing, a bunch of, like, drunk, frustrated, lonely men are set upon by, like, the ultimate alien predator, basically.
Yeah.
Which can imitate them and, you know, can fool them at any turn and, you know, sow discontentment among them. And it's kind of about that inadequate masculinity and, like, that rage. And in the sequel, it's supposed to be, like, the Norwegian camp. So in theory, it takes place, like, a month or something before the movie The Thing.
Mm.
But in that, it opens with a team of like xenobiologist experts or like cryptozoologists being called to the research base.
Mm.
And so it's a bit like, so hang on, you followed up a film where the whole point of it was that everyone there had no idea what was going on and were totally unqualified to deal with it, with literally a film where a team of specialists are the protagonists. And I sort of think I think that's part of the problem, is you just go, it's just not as exciting if these people are semi-expecting what they find there, because that's their job, you know?
I know, and I think sometimes as well with, like, I'm not sure whether you share it, I've got this documentary I downloaded a long, long time ago called The 100 Worst Movies Ever Made. And it's something to, like, to look at, kind of in the 60s, where they had like a span of just terrible B movies, where there would be like zombies or voodoo ghosts or whatever, but it would just be the same man in a gorilla suit for each one. and then I think sometimes you kind of get that love of something being bad, and then never kind of wanting it to change or be made better or be kind of polished, like the Star Wars films. And, you know, they weren't necessarily bad, but they've aged. And then, you know, having that, because it takes away from the good memories you have with it. I mean, like quoting a show that I think the only people who have listened to it are you and I and maybe two other people. And that's Last Orders, the one I previously did.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Which, I mean, I say very good. It was me going, how many voices can I do that at least sound different from each other?
Yeah, but that's what I do, Francis, so I can't claim any superiority.
I think I was chatting with my mum, and she said, and I was talking about doing another show and getting casted, and she was like, oh, you could get a cast to redo the other show. And I mentioned it to a friend, I think the third person who listened to the show. And he was like, no, you can't, it's terrible, but I love it. And
like, I think that's a bit harsh, but sure.
I don't know. I think, yeah, that is a little quote for the poster if there was ever one, written in crayon at the top.
It's terrible, but I love it. Yeah, great.
But I think, and maybe that kind of circles back to the fact that because it's a podcast and because, you know, that a lot more effort is being made, and it's kind of done, especially when it's indie and it's done kind of grassroots and ground up. And I think that was like a lot of like Wooden Overcoats. I mean, apart from the fact that the writing was superb, the actors were absolutely fantastic. I remember. I mean, obviously yourself, but also Beth Eyre with kind of Like Audrey Hepburn with the meth problem. Like, it was, and I mean that with the most love in the world. And you could tell there was just this wonderful bit of effort. And I mean, I have trivia about the show, but obviously you know the trivia because you were in it.
Sure, but confirm all the nice and bits if that's helpful. While you've got me here,
the soundtrack was recorded just up the road from me.
Mm-hmm.
In the John Lydon Concert Hall at York University.
Yes, James Whittle, the composer leaving York University, really put a dent in our resources for for recording the score. But we made do.
But yet again, you would. I mean, and I'm going to paint a very big stereotypical picture with lots of broad brushstrokes here.
Go for it.
But your average drama podcast is in a world post-apocalyptic sci-fi fantasy zombie outbreaky. There's just like one guy with a Casio keyboard doing the music.
Yeah. again, that's what I do, Francis. That's not, you can't keep criticizing the things that I do. Yeah.
but having a full orchestra for a podcast drama, you know, I'm sure at the time might have been like, dude, is this work? And but like actually it absolutely 100% paid off because it creates a sort of cinematic feel, and I think it hopefully there'll be sort of more in the line that sort of take that that process. I'm not going to mention the show because I want them to do well, and I don't want to slag them off.
Sure.
I found a new drama I think just recommended to me through Spotify, and it was about like the goings on, the dark goings on behind a nice quiet suburban neighborhood, and I was like, oh, this might be a bit like Blue Velvet. A bit of dark drama, and it was body horror and zombies.
Oh.
And it wasn't even a drama. It was one person reading a book. That's an audiobook. That's not a drama. And that alone, unfortunately, angered me so much that I stopped listening.
Isn't it? I think there's something about like managing expectations that is important. I mean, that's a huge question about, you know, marketing and you know, your digital presence and all this. But you know, it can really put you off. There's a sort of a broader umbrella description has come out precisely because of how many shows there are where it's just a monologue. Pardon me, burping in the morning.
Wait.
Where there's, you know, a lot, you can leave that in. Where there, where there's, you know, someone narrating like more ambitious events. I mean, and in a way that makes sense to me. Mm. I think in a good way and sometimes a bad way, there's a real closely knit connection between podcasting, like fiction, and fan fiction.
Mm.
And I think some people who are kind of getting into creating their own fantasy and sci-fi, like genre-y things, they're people who've come from a world of writing fan fiction first. And I think that, you know, basically people who write fan fiction are just people who want to write are young and haven't begun having their own ideas for you know, worlds yet. Or, you know, people who just like doing it for its own sake, that's totally fine. Mm. But I think that, you know, there is a certain kind of, you know, it's a cliche, it's a stereotype, and it probably doesn't apply to a lot of the fan fiction stuff, but like there's a cliche of it all being kind of too much immediate gratification, also like kind of in the way that a show will often not give the public what they think they want. Fan fiction's there to give it to them immediately in the most sort of, you know, immediately gratifying and direct way, in a way that probably the program creators didn't intend. But, you know, I think there is something that is accepting and inclusive about fan fiction communities in the way that audio drama or broadly audio fiction has begun to include. And I think the trouble is that when something comes out that is just, you know, and this is not meant as a criticism, but if it's somebody who is just literally reading into their iPhone a story that they've written and they're releasing it as, you know, audio fiction, and it's in the same category as your show that was spent weeks and months and hours to put together with hundreds of people, you go, that's not the same. But ultimately, you know, we're all just people making up stories, recording them and putting them on podcast feeds. So I can't really, don't see there's much way to criticise.
That's the thing, and I think, like, I know when I say stuff like this, I get massive cases of imposter syndrome, because I've only really been doing this for about a year.
Mm. And really, like, amazingly proficient for considering that. Like, you've made a really ambitious attempt twice now at, like, doing a show where you're just doing everything yourself, and then secondly, getting a big cast together. Like, I think it's really impressive. Like, after a year of knobbing about with audio, I definitely wouldn't have been able to produce anything as sophisticated as this. And with original music and stuff as well. Like,
yes. You know. Absolutely. And I think it's been a big learning curve for me writing writing podcast music, because it's usually because I did songwriting beforehand, and then you write stuff that wants to sort of stand out and kind of be a bit of an earworm and kind of catch attention quite quickly. And then whereas when you're writing sort of podcast music or scoring music, that you want something to be there to give a general idea of what's going on.
Yeah.
But not to take over what's going on with the dialogue. Like the mistake, I think it was the first iteration of the pilot I sent you. I didn't know what to do with music cues and linking scenes up. So I'll just write something and play it for 15 seconds, and then that'll be the next scene. And universally feedback from everybody was like, that is too long between scenes.
Yeah. It's tough. It's so strange. I remember years ago having the first time I ever did a sort of sketch comedy, you know, homemade radio show. I think you couldn't even call it a podcast because it was just me and friends. The sketch group Sad Faces, well, as we later became, we threw together a couple of MP3s of all now, I think, long lost. I don't know if that's true. I hope you don't find them. They're probably terrible. But anyway, this was like back in the early 2000s, I guess, when, you know, podcasting probably just about existed, but it was early days. We were very ahead of our time, is what I'm saying. But so we had a friend who was in the music managing business, and at the time she was managing a band called Good Books, who achieved sort of minor indie superstar success in Britain at the time. And they had a great song. I forget which of theirs it was that we used, actually, but we used an instrumental segment of that song in our little MP3 thing. And, you know, we wrote an email to our friend, and she passed it on to the band, and they were going, yes, that's wonderful. Feel free. No problem. Because they knew, you know, we weren't going to be getting anywhere with this tiny, you know, teenager sketch show. And I remember trying to cut down a little sort of bit of music sting to as short as it needed to be, based on like what sketch shows I'd heard and things like that, like, and shows with scene transitions. And every time I cut it down, it felt too long. And so it just ended up with like, durr, and that was it. Like, end of a sketch, durr. And people going, that's too short. And I went, no, you know, it's really impactful and it gets the message across, but it doesn't hang around. I think I did go too far. But it's weird. It's a really weird rhythm to get your head around, especially when you're bringing in other elements like narration, music and stuff. It's very, very, very hard to get a knack for that.
Absolutely. And I think, and I'll plug these guys because they've helped me out greatly. One of the only very few good things that happened in 2020 was that an audio company called Spitfire Audio that specialise in VSTs for orchestras, the standard VSTs, average price £800 per software. It's like professional level budget wise. Yeah. But they released a thing called Labs, which is like a piece of software where you can then download lots of VSTs that are free to use and free to download. And they also then gave a cut down version of the VST BBC Symphonic Orchestra, and then made a YouTube series on how to write for orchestra.
Oh, wow.
A lot of, I mean, I went nuts with this, I think episode 2, I started writing like massive orchestrations to all the things that were going on, that it became rather too dramatic for actually what was unfolding.
But it's good to explore that voice. I mean, what else are you going to do with your own show?
But I think it seems to be like the coolest thing at this point in time about making, audio drama, is that the resources you have at your fingertips, you know, I mean, give it 10, 15 years back, you would have to like order either a hard drive or a CD-ROM with 500 sound effects for a lot of money.
Absolutely,
you're
going to
only
use
that four, maybe. And then now you've got websites like Epidemic Sound where you've just, you know, monthly for fee, and then you get loads of, you know, cloud stored sound effects, and even things like room tones, which make absolutely no sense to anybody outside of that recording environment.
Yeah.
It's like 25 different room tones to use. And I'm going to plug you again, because I did see this recently, that you are starting a course, an online course in podcast.
Absolutely, yes, this has begun. The second one is, at the time of recording, just about to start, but I don't know if it'll still be open for applications. But either way, with City Academy, which is a London-based adult learning centre, well, since the pandemic has begun, I think they and a lot of other educational institutions have been trying to juggle when it's responsible to do in-studio teaching and when it's still not quite safe enough. And there's been a lot of stopping and starting for them. And my response to that has been to say from the beginning, absolutely no way, I'll do you a digital course only. So that's been my very game approach. But yeah, so in the end, we talked about a format and stuff, and so I'm doing an online only, so just over Zoom, podcasting for beginners. And if you want to learn all about orchestration using Spitfire software and things like that, you won't get that. But if you want to know the very basics of how to make a recording not sound terrible, how to use your own kit, how to use digital audio workstations to edit, it really is just the basics. But it covers the basics of every area. So there's a little bit of radio script writing. There's a little bit of editing and using filters to get the purest possible, like voice take and stuff like that. So it's a real overview. And I think you are, and I think people already have from my first course, I think you can expect to do it and then leave ready to start a show. And one person at least has already started a show as a result of it. So I'm really pleased.
That's cool.
That. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I think it's really needed. I mean, like, Muggins Ear just thought of doing one for free on YouTube. Like, not the smartest man in the room at the moment. I think, like, obviously, I won't get you to divulge your secrets that will only be available on the course. We'll keep that stum.
For what they're worth. Yeah, fine.
But I thought it'd be also quite an interesting environment to talk a little bit more about sort of the bits of writing and making audio dramas that we care a lot about that the general public probably don't. On my end, it's quite difficult to know whether there is a fan base or not.
Of course,
I can see numbers on a screen, but there's no real sort of palpable thing that you can see in front of you.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming that there will be people out there who listen to your work and mine who may be like starting out. And obviously, number one would be to go on a course where someone who knows what they're doing teaches you, like Tom. When some people come up to me and asking for sort of writing advice and kind of where to start, and they kind of want to get started on a project where they want to write either a piece of fan fiction or any other kind of a genre and take it to a cast, what I've seen for the biggest kind of bit of writer's block is to try and keep the story in kind of one line without it kind of becoming too like complex and complicated, because there can be sometimes quite difficult to convey really intricate, like you couldn't do like Mission Impossible, the first movie, in an audio drama without a narrator going on for 7 billion hours to give all the exposition needed.
Yeah.
But like, what'd be interesting is to kind of just compare sort of styles of writing. Because mine's a little out there. I tend to not do most of my writing on a computer screen. I tend to go into the woods with a dictaphone and play act the thing that I want to do.
Oh, lovely. Yes.
And scare dog walkers because I'm 6'5" and usually wearing a massive coat and a hood. But for me, that's I used to write, I mean, not subpar, but not brilliant dialogue until I started doing it out loud.
Yeah, you livened it up a bit. Yeah, no, that makes sense.
So I was interested in kind of what kind of method you use when sort of, let's say you're doing like an episode of Crowley Time and you go, okay, I've got an episode. It needs to be, you know, roughly half an hour. Like, where do you sort of start off with ideas and stuff?
Well, I think one thing that's important to point out is that, as you've just demonstrated, everyone's process is different. I think a lot of people, especially when they're approaching writing from the perspective of, you know, someone who's not involved in any professional industry about it, or you know, don't have any peers who also do it to compare themselves to, it's very easy to think, oh, I'm doing it wrong. I don't have a big cork board in my house where all of the threads of the plot are being marked between with wire. So I'm doing it wrong. I can't write properly. I haven't done it properly. And there are as many different writing processes as there are writers. And probably every single one is deeply dysfunctional, but also gets the job done. I expect that's true. But I'm very traditional and dull. I recently, actually, I saw a Writers Guild BAFTA talk. No, it wasn't BAFTA, it was Writers Guild. A Writers Guild Q&A with Russell T. Davis talking about It's a Sin, among other things. And people, one, the technical question of like outlining came up. And he was going, oh, I don't outline ever. I just write it and feel it as it goes and all that. And people in the chat, you know, sycophants, let's be honest, were all going, oh, yes, I totally agree. Yes, absolutely, yes. No, I never outline. You should never do it. It kills the writing. And I thought, that's a shame because I outline everything quite meticulously. Like when I'm writing a bigger project, like a, you know, a TV pitch or a screenplay or whatever, like I always, or a play, you know, I've never, if anything, I recently wrote a 15-minute pilot for a thing that hasn't gone anywhere, so don't get excited. But it was just 15 minutes. It was a deliberately very, very simple premise of a sitcom with just two sort of main characters in a situation, you know, like a lot of different plays and sitcoms have been before. And it was literally, I started writing it and I came up with a few good jokes, but I just couldn't get a sense of where the thrust of like the action of it was going.
Absolutely.
And so I had to stop and I saved some of the lines that I thought were good. I was only 2 pages into like a script that was aimed at being 15 minutes. And I sat down and just like as an abstract wrote just in prose what was going to happen. And like even things like, oh, this happens, which makes that guy remember this thing, which makes him say this. You know, just like getting the sort of tennis ball back and forth of where this conversation went and what sparked off what happening. And then like I wrote the draft in about a day, like, you know, after that, you know, and it's I need to outline. So anyway, point being, everyone works differently. That said, when it comes to Crowley time, sketch comedy generally, but Crowley time especially, that is like the only time I've really improvised something. Like there are a few sketches in the show that are, I've just had an idea, then put the microphone on and step back and forth, like yourself in the woods, just kind of going through it, you know, in real time. Not, you know, I've cut the gaps out in between because I can't be in two places at once, but, you know, largely just writing it as I say it. And that's really fun. I haven't done that for a while, actually. I feel like something that, for one thing, it's a very quick way to come up with you know, episode filling, delicious content. But it also did lend a sort of excitement to it. And it does mean that there are sketches. For example, there's the sketch which is, if anyone's heard the podcast, it's two Australian men at a seaside arguing with each other about some like minor social slight that one of them committed at one of his wife's birthday parties. And it ends with one of them like producing this vial of like flesh-eating bacteria from his pocket and saying that if he doesn't get the apology he wants, he's going to destroy the western coast of Australia. You know, and I think it was the western coast. Anyway, and that was just something that came out of a simple kind of exercise almost of like an escalation game where I was playing with myself, playing to similar Australian men. And I think it's a really funny sketch. It's got a silly tacked on punchline, but that's not important. But you know, that wouldn't have, I wouldn't have sat down and thought that was worth writing, for example, but I think it's actually really funny in the end.
No, I completely agree. Like I know when I was doing Last Orders and Last Orders was very much, I mean, Purgatory has been every sort of episode we started off going, no one knows what we're doing, cool, let's go. But Last Orders was definitely, I didn't know what I was doing. Like I still record radio drama in Ableton. That's how backward I am.
Right, wow, okay.
Just a little audio geek joke there.
Sure beats Audacity, am I right, guys? Hello?
Is Seven glasses pairing.
Hello?
A similar thing where I can't remember the episode where like I think the character of Martin was tasked to do something, and I had like a formula for that show which was they try to do something, they fail badly, nobody learns from it, they continue as kind of like your bog standard like British sitcom-y sort of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a structure.
So I think I had the character of Miranda, which was me doing a woefully offensive Irish accent.
Again, that's what I do. Francis, please. Stop with these veiled slights at me. Anyway, yes.
But like, so the first line was, so today's the day. And I was saying this walking in the woods. Then I thought it would be funny. And in my head, I had this response of Martin going, the teddy bears have their... And like, just kind of finishing that lyric off. And yet again, if I'd seen those words on a screen, I would have not made that correlation. I also very much agree with you that I think for any sort of writers who are especially when they're starting out, because when I started out, I was about maybe 16 years old, and I wrote the film that got me into script writing, which was not the probably I don't, it was an unexpected film to get somebody into script writing, but it was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, not like dialogue focused to my memory, but yeah,
it's a really Pinterest film.
lots of pauses while fighting happens. Yeah.
But I all I wanted to do was make martial arts epics. I thought that would be a good job to do in the UK.
Do you know what I mean? Was it, what's his name, who did The Raid? Gareth Edwards?
Oh yes, in Indonesia. Yeah,
he went, his lovely Welsh boy went off to become a globally recognised kung fu director, so it's not impossible.
Like I wrote, and it thankfully will never see the light of day, it was called The Sixth Adventurer. Already in the 1970s ballpark.
I beg his pardon, sorry, Gareth Evans.
Oh, right.
An even more Welsh name, but sorry, carry on.
And it was terrible from start to finish. And the second thing I wrote was the first iteration of Purgatory, which was called Broken Hearts and Gay Jokes, which summarised my teenage life quite well.
And a lot of people in the UK, I think.
I have to say, yeah. When I was in my early 20s, I finally started reading like Robert McKee and Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, right.
Like your two kind of big schools of like you sort of start as a Robert McKee guy or a Joseph Campbell guy. And you.
Well, did you ever read William Goldman's book?
Oh, no.
Because that was mine. Adventures in the Screen Trade, that was mine. And it's not even that helpful as like a manual for the basics. You know, it's more that it's someone who's quite aggressively in favour of like good writing, just sort of being angry about things, and you go, oh, it's strangely inspiring. And it also just got me to watch more of his films, which are like masterclasses in themselves of like screenwriting, like Butch Cassidy and Misery and stuff, and it's like
okay,
stunning.
Right, that clicks. I think there is an importance to kind of learn the craft to begin. I think the like, especially when I was at university, and the thing that was really popular was like, we're going to make this film to break the conventions and rules of film. We don't know what they are to begin with, but we're going to break them.
I think, do you know what? I haven't read McKee or any of those more kind of analytical things. Like, I did read William Goldman, both of his books, and I loved them. But I haven't really, you know, got into that Dan Harmon stuff of like the character wheel and all that, really. Partly, I think, because I think those things, what those people do really well is to take good storytelling instincts, which are developed over time, and then boil them down into something that you can read very quickly. And I think that's very, very useful. But I think I am pissy and idiosyncratic enough that I go, I want to learn it for myself. And so, like, having just watched all the, you know, films I've loved the most in my life, you do find yourself like analysing them as you go. And I think that that's kind of how I decided to educate myself, so to speak. I mean, maybe I'm missing some very obvious stuff that I would have learned if I'd read those books. But I think something that is important. Oh, Christ, I've lost my train of thought. What did you just say? You were talking about.
So I think as a good place to start off if you're learning about like the techniques is the structure element.
Yes, not breaking the rules before you know them. Yeah, that's very true. I think it is important to know the sort of conventions before you try to transgress them too much. But I mean, some people just arrive fully formed like a potato, like, and it's just, they're geniuses at writing and storytelling, and they didn't need any inspirations or anything. They just arrive, but. You know, for most of us, I think it is, you are always playing with the conventions that you've learned over time. And I think something which is maybe the biggest note I've ever had for any, you know, for everybody whose work I've ever read is like, do not underestimate the importance of tell the story clearly. And I say this a lot whenever I'm teaching. It's like, you know, whenever talking about fictional stuff, I mean, even nonfiction, you know, journalism and stuff, I think people are, in a post-Tarantino world, people love a disconnected narrative, and they love a sort of a chopped up story out of order. And they love feet, apparently. I don't know. I don't get that part. But anyway, in a post.
How to become a reader. Learn to love feet.
That's it. Yeah, that's how to really succeed.
My new book.
Get really into feet. But no, but I think that is all very good. But the thing is, like, people who do that sort of thing, and people like the Coens who play with storytelling in that way and things like that, like, they started by knowing incredibly well-told linear stories. You know, they started out by making those, or by understanding how those work and loving those stories. And I think there is that thing, certainly as we enter an age when more and more stuff is perfectly documented and captured for all time, I think it's tempting to start with the most recent thing and sort of try and learn from everything all at once and to go, you know, I mean, back in a pre-internet time, you would just be learning from whatever was available, like what VHS tapes were in the shop around the corner and, you know, what was being aired on telly. So your influences were far more minimal. And now I think with the complete history of all documented creativity at our fingertips, it can be intimidating and also quite sort of, you can feel overwhelmed by inspiration and by different ways you could approach telling a story. But I think it's always a good idea to start from tell the story clearly. By which I don't mean necessarily tell a simple story. Like, you can write Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. But as long as you've told that story clearly, there are infinite numbers of twists, discoveries, double crosses, you know. But the story is told clearly because we know what we are and aren't supposed to know at different times.
Absolutely. And I mean, like, I remember when I was in my teens and I submitted a film to the UK Film Council's, like, yearly film competition, which, I mean, I got to the finalists, but I didn't win by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, that's great.
A good
well
thing,
done.
Because the movie would have been terrible. It was called Going Missing. It was about two teenagers who got really drunk and high, drove away from the town that they were sick and tired of living in, accidentally went on a ferry to France, and then had no petrol, no money, no knowledge of the French language, and had like... fend for themselves. And I did my like first of a treatment. The whole thing was really rushed. Like, I had the premise, but I had no idea how to finish it, so I just wrote some garbage gobbledygook sort of patter. And then the feedback I got, to circle back to what you said, they would say, the guy said there was a fine line between complex and complicated. And you crossed it doing this, and
and that line, buddy, is way behind you.
Triple jumped, backflipped, stuck the landing, like,
clear over that line, baby. Yeah. Anyway,
and I think that's that. So I guess it comes from experience of doing it repeatedly.
Oh, totally. I also think that learning by doing it, I mean, this takes us back to like self-publishing and YouTube podcasts, is learning by doing is some of the most useful stuff you can do. There is also a thing, I think this is basically a good problem to have, which is that you don't have a sort of editor or a censor or a commissioner in these areas. All you've kind of got is the patience and the, you know, the generosity of feedback of your audience. And I think the trouble with that is obviously people are less likely to get better at what they do as they go on, because if they're just told they're a genius over and over again, they're not going to learn any lessons about how their stuff isn't working.
Absolutely.
And I think in that situation, the best thing you can do is have a jury of your peers, like people that you trust who you send stuff to. Like, I'm certainly like that. Like, I mean, because also being who I am and like doing what I do, which is I'm either, you know, making stuff that's going to be released straight away to the public, like Crowley Time, and or, you know, acting under things. Or I'm writing stuff that will probably never see the light of day, like pitching stuff for radio and telly and things like that. So it's you know, to make sure that is ready to send. Sometimes you just trust your instincts, like the sitcom thing that was like a 15-minute format before. I wrote it, like I say, when I finally started the draft that ended up being the draft, it was done in a day, and I just straight away sent it to two producers who I knew well enough that they would read it and not just go, what are you doing sending me this half-finished rubbish? But but like, usually if it's something that's a bit more of a departure for me, like a genre I haven't worked in before, or a chunkier project, then you want to have like that list of, who knows, 5 to 50 people who you think would want to help you out by reading it, but also who maybe their taste, their aesthetic is aligned with yours. So they won't go, it's shit. They'll go, oh, I see what you've tried to do here. It's a sort of thing I like in films or telly or whatever. But I think the way you could more effectively do it is this, you know, because it's, you know, you don't often have, if you're making something yourself, whether that's writing something speculatively or making something totally of your own and self-published, you don't have that stage where, you know, unless you have a collaborative relationship like you do with Purgatory, where you have actors reading the work, you know, you're at the mercy of people who are involved in making it, and then you're at the mercy of listeners. And that's quite ruthless in some ways, because like you said earlier, like if you listen to something that's not what you expected, you can just angrily throw it across the room and never look at it again. You've got very little time to make a first impression, especially in the sort of saturated market of, you know, the internet.
Yeah.
And so that's tough. But I think that, yeah, I suppose that's, I can't remember how I got onto this, but I would say it is helpful. If you ever feel like you need a little bit of guidance, like, don't be afraid to ask your peers like what they think of your stuff, and listen to them. You know, even if you disagree with the feedback they give you, try and think about why they've said that. Look for the note behind the note, I think they call it.
You know,
if someone says, I don't buy this romance, don't immediately cut that romance from your script. Just go, well, why wasn't it convincing? Why didn't it seem necessary when I know it was necessary for that to be in there? What can I do to make it feel necessary to the reader? Things like that.
I think it's quite a good rite of passage for any writer, like, to have, you know, that's why, like I said, they you know, tell certain people, if you're going to write comedy, do stand up, because you get that real time feedback of it's either going to work or it's not.
Yeah.
And then it's like kind of licking your wounds, going back in and figuring out how to do it again. Like, I think sometimes because when I had the pilot of Purgatory, and by that point it was just, let's see if we can just make a pilot, and will it have legs enough to be a long-running show?
Yeah.
And I think whilst it is excellent to have a good varied amount of feedback from very different people, there's one type of feedback which I know sometimes happens in like our little circle, which is not necessarily feedback, but it's people kind of passive aggressively telling they're better writers than you. So I only had it once, and it was in the pilot, where the majority was, you know, either like I liked it or I didn't like it, and I didn't like it because of this. And then, like, when I had your, I mean, absolutely wonderful, I think it was a couple of page email, like really detailedly going into it, which was vital at the time.
Something really thorough,
just to help grow it. And then somebody rang up who had listened to the pilot, and the first thing he said was, I have notes.
Oh no!
and sometimes and it happens so much on the stand-up circuit, where you would have one guy doing their first performance, they would, you know, and your first performance doing stand-up is never going to be the best thing you ever do, and if it is, that's, you should just quit there and then, because you're not
leave it there.
Keep it a perfect moment. But like, they used to get disseminated by other performers who would give that sort of like feedback, and I think what the nice thing that I've seen with kind of dipping my toes into audio drama and kind of slowly kind of becoming part of the community, is that just didn't happen at all. With kind of chatting to other shows and guys like yourself, there seems to be this really nice supportive atmosphere that encourages new people to get involved in it and to get their stuff made, because just getting it made and doing it would be, you know, as good as years and years of experience, because you get that like real time feedback from cast, and if things don't work, and you have to work them until they do.
I think also, like, I think that suggests that you are writing wrongs with your work, which isn't what it is. What it is that learning to collaborate in that way is very important, because, you know, there's never been a piece of work that involved actors working on it where, you know, there was no element of collaboration. So it's not that you're using your collaborators to help you, you know, fix something you've got wrong. Not at all. It's that every kind of piece of creative work that has any kind of collaborative team element to it, there will always be times when the sum of everyone's thoughts is greater than, you know, just one person. And I think that, and certainly like that, you know, I'm sort of taking a sort of holistic look at it, where like the final product will always be the product of more than one person, unless it is something like crowd design where it's just me. But, you know, whenever you're working with multiple people, you know, it's important to take in that creative energy, because, you know, you it is stronger for the more voices that are, you know, channeled responsibly, I guess, into it. And I think that that is, you know, you don't how not to look at it is, I must have got that line wrong because that actor told me a better line, and even I knew it was a better line, and I put it in, but that wasn't me, so I failed. A way to look at it is like, I wrote a really good script, and if it had been filmed like or recorded like this word for word, it would have been good, but it's better for having had that dynamic response from like a bigger team. But anyway, sorry, that was just a little aside.
No, I don't. It's nice to say, and I think it's and I mean, like, because I had a really large gap in which I stopped kind of doing this, because I've sort of started a lot later with creating stuff and working with actors. But I remember when myself and my family went to see a comedy about bank robbery.
Oh, yes,
in
yes.
London, with my favourite company, Misty Theatre.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I will try not to just go on singing their praises, but...
sure.
Just the mastercraft of physical comedy.
Really very, very elaborate. I had a friend who was, I guess if there is a lead, he was the lead in Play That Goes Wrong for a year on the West End.
Oh, my.
And it just sounded exhausting. Because it's so intricate and so incredibly complex, the choreography of it. And the set work, like, and also you need to know what to do if something actually goes wrong, so you don't get killed by falling set. So it was really...
Buster Keaton approach, yeah.
Exactly. And you need like 7 brains and a lot of stamina. But it sounded incredible people.
They were, and it was so, so great watching it like live in the audience. And I remember checking my brother outside of it, and I'm like, I miss so much sitting in a room with a bunch of other people, and the sole reason for us being there is to make each other laugh.
Yeah.
And I think that's like the joy I found with getting back into this. And it's something that I think would be one of the most encouraging things for new people to get involved, that like, if you're in a good room with good people, and you just realize the sole purpose of that is to make everybody happy, and create something, then it'd be a really good way to like get it done. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought there.
No, that's fine. It's a big thought, but it's an important one. No, I totally agree. It's like that joy of collaboration. I mean, even when it's got no purpose. Mm. There's a great John Cleese lecture about creativity as play. I think it's all on YouTube and you can find it. It's from the 80s or early 90s. And he's doing this talk to a German video company, by which I mean I think they sort of produced, you know, video art or advertising or whatever.
Mm.
And it's just a great talk where he talks about how entering the state of play is key to creativity, and it's what a writer feels when they are halfway through a scene and suddenly the words are just flying out of their fingers onto the screen. You know, like it's when an actor is really feeling, you know, they're kind of sharing a vibe with this fictional character they're playing. You know, that state of, they call it flow as well, but it's that sense of being free in your head to explore and to create. And it's a really nice speech, and I think there's something to be said for just that and making a habit out of, you know, either just with the things that you're making yourself or with people that you know and love, is, you know, gravitating towards those activities and those people that help you to just feel that state of play. Anyway, I mean, in lockdown especially, it's been interesting to sort of have phone calls with lots of different people and to sort of find the people who I find that I just immediately become silly, you know, with, and end up laughing a lot. And there's a lot of them. And it's, you know, if I've been phoning you a lot during lockdown, this is you. But it's people who you realize just help you to access that, because you, and it's joy. It's joy at and relaxation. It's all kinds of factors, but it is that sense of, it's what they say about Vic and Bob, basically. Like whenever Vic and Bob are asked, like, well, how do you still produce such good stuff together after so many years? It's like they go, well, we make each other laugh. And that's it, you know, like if Vic puts on a fez and starts doing a strange Cossack dance around the office, Bob will laugh at that and they'll go, maybe we should put that in the show. But, you know, that's the sort of, that's a good model to follow, I think.
I think it was Neil Gaiman. I'll quote a guy, have you ever heard of Keith Johnson?
I've heard of him. Improv, yes.
Yes. So that is one book I could definitely recommend if you're going down the comedy route for sort of first time writers. But he says a quote in this book, because he did kind of improv workshops with children and adults, and he said the big difference between children and adults is adults just want one perfect turn, whereas children want as many turns as possible.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah.
And I think especially when I've had like worries about being able to like create content or write a full episode of something. Like, for example, I don't know whether I think it must have been done before. I don't know. Wooden Overcoats did a version. So I'm trying to write episode 7 of Purgatory is going to be a musical episode.
Yeah.
A bit like Circa Buffy.
Yes.
1990s. Not just recording a musical remotely during lockdown. I mean, that's future Francis's problem, not current.
Yeah. Set him a challenge and then wait for him to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. And then, like, I was thinking, I was getting really, really nervous about it all because I was like, it's got to be good and the song's got to be good, but they've also got to have a point and all that sort of stuff. And then sort of took a step back and went, hold on for a second here. You're making a show which people are listening to, and you've got a cast, and you've got an opportunity to do a musical, which was just completely unheard of like a year ago.
Yeah.
Just have fun with it. And then it became like a lot easier, not necessarily easier to do, but like I stopped having like aneurysms as a result.
Trying to put that together. Yeah. I think that's really interesting. I think it's, I can see how it feels more difficult when you're doing. Well, you're kind of recording like a full formed sort of drama, sitcom, podcast, almost on the fly. You know, you're releasing as you go, and that is tough because that prevents you from having the oversight to record the whole thing and then release it week by week. You know, in maybe the same way we did for Wooden Overcoats. You know, the whole thing was written and then read through and edited and then recorded and then released in a batch. And you know, that does reduce the spontaneity of it. But we were really aping the way that radio and telly are made. And this is something very different. And the thing I really love about Crowley Time is that it is probably the best I have ever captured the inner workings of like my own mind. Like, I hesitate to go like, it's a perfect distillation of my skewed view of reality. It's like, no, it's just what I think's funny. I'm not going to put any more of a grandiose label on it than that. But, you know, it's idle thoughts that I have that I'll maybe just say out loud to my partner and it'll make her laugh. And I'll, you know, whereas before you might put it in the category of like, you had to be there. I think I've got better at going, no, but what do I think's funny about that? And how can that be distilled down into a, you know, short sketch? Or in my case, a sketch that's several minutes too long. but yeah, and I think that what's really good about Crowley Time for me, like in a selfish sense, is that it's a mental scrapbook. I've said this before, but when I started it, I sort of thought, I love sketch comedy. I've always loved sketch comedy. I came up wanting to make it and then performing it, writing it. It was my introduction to the whole world of writing and performing. And it's always been part of the DNA of how I think about things. And it's also perfect because it's modular inherently. And so you can cut away to a new character or a returning character or a song for no reason other than, well, you're all expecting something new to happen now. Like the possibilities are infinite. And what's nice about it for me is, you know, you can go anywhere, do anything, as long as it has something funny. There's some sort of funny carrot at the end of that journey to enjoy. And it's also, it allows you to be quite, unfiltered sounds wrong because it sounds like I'm like it's an audition piece for GB News or something. I don't mean like, you know, I can say horrible things about people of other races. I mean, you know, if an idea is too stupid or too silly or it seems too obscure to get. In the first episode of Crowley Time, there is a joke about one line in the film Jurassic Park, which in anything else, like if I was submitting that to a producer, I'd never ever think of bothering to even develop that as an idea. But the fact that I've sort of given myself the tools where I can not only write it, but then record it and produce it and release it in a supportive environment. I mean, that is a boon to me. Like, I think, do you know what I mean? Like, it takes the pressure off completely. And the other nice thing about it is, having released like 15 of the things at this point, like the people who found it and really liked it, they do really like it. And they're kind of going, you know, either tacitly or explicitly, they're going, yeah, we like this thing that you do, just keep doing that. And then that gives you the freedom to explore all these sort of weird corners of ideas or ways of expressing ideas that you might not otherwise try. And that is, I think, a really nice thing to aim for. And I think it's really impressive that you can get yourself to that state, again, in a situation where you are collaborating with quite a few other people and where you've got this sort of ongoing story and, you know, these character arcs that you need to be fulfilling, you know, as you go. I think that's fantastic.
I mean, it's kind of therapeutic in a way. There's a catharsis to it. Because I mean, like, you know, I have very sort of similar thoughts and jokes in my day job as a nurse, I would definitely not say. But yeah, in the confines of a show in a fictionalized environment, would work. Like, I mean, I commend you for being able to write so much in sketch form, because it is a form of writing I just cannot do.
It's really strange. I've heard this before. Like, I often sort of bemoan the fact that there aren't any sketch shows on telly anymore, or there are very few, because, like, at the minute in Britain, if you're not able to produce your own work, or you haven't got the time or the money or whatever, you've got one avenue, which is Newsjack on 4Extra. Like, Radio 4Extra, it's the only open submissions show out there in the world, in the UK at all. Yeah. And then you submit stuff to that. And firstly, it's really hard to get stuff on there, because the odds are somebody else has done your joke already that week. Mm. And if they've already done, if they've covered the same topic or taken the same take on that topic, yours is going in the bin. Like, it's just, it's the realities of, like, having so many submissions. Mm. So it requires a lot of luck and also a lot of ability to get something on that show. Mm. But then the other problem with that is, there's only really one place you can go from that opportunity. Mm. And other than that, you know, there's what, 4 to 6 episodes a year, or every few months of that. Mm. And if you get something on there, that's great. If you get several things on there, they might invite you to apply to be the sort of the bursary writer, or what's now called, I think, the staff writer. Yeah. And that is 2 positions per year.
Yeah.
And then if you don't get that, there is nowhere else to go other than, you know, trying to put on your own plays, make your own podcast, trying to secure an agent, find contacts with producers. Mm. And all these things are possible, but there is no, like, there is no above board way to make that journey, if you see what I mean. There's no route, so to speak. Like, how, you know, in the States, I think there's more of a culture of trying to get a job, like a proper job as, like, an agent's assistant, because it's different over there and writers are waged. Mm. They're not over here. It's all freelance. Yeah. And so there is the only, you know, if you followed the rules to the letter, like, if you didn't contact people who said, we don't take any submissions from unrepresented people, or we don't take any unsolicited submissions of scripts or whatever, you would stop dead. You know, there would be nowhere to go. But unfortunately, the industry is made up of whispers, and this person knows this person, and, oh, I can probably get you so-and-so's email address, you know, and that is fine. That's just how it works. I get it. Mm. But, you know, I think there's something so important. It should be different. And I think that, I bemoan the lack of sketch shows for that reason, because at least there, over the years, you had all of these shows that were desperate for content. Like, they needed material, they needed sketches. Mm. And you could contact the producers, send them, like, a bushel of 5 scripts. And if they thought they were okay, you might get something on telly. Mm. You know, and now it's just that sort of thing isn't being made. I mean, hopefully that will come back again. But the flip side of that is, if you cannot make sketches work for you, then it's of no help anyway.
Well, I think it's, I mean, I've had the same rant. I'll have this rant without saying the name, because but they're so big that, like, it'll probably be guessed quite quickly.
Right.
So, I 100% agree with you about how the monopoly of Radio 4 on radio drama and comedy means that if there is no competition, there is no diversity. I'm one of my girlfriend's friends, like, when I was trying to get, like, a group of really different people, they're in their early 20s, they lived in York at the time, and I asked them if they had just listened to a radio drama before, and it was like, no. And I was like, oh, what sort of draw you away from it? And they were like, well, it's just a bunch of posh people talking, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it was like, oh yeah, actually it is.
It really is. I think that there's a... It's
a lot of alienation.
I think that there have been definite like steps to try and improve that. And I think that, you know, the afternoon play on Radio 4, I think, is trapped in a bit of a... It's trapped in what is perceived to be Radio 4's like audience and responsibility.
Mm.
Because, you know, Radio 4 is expected to cater to people 50 years old plus, probably white, and, you know, and probably not engaging that much with television or other sort of forms of media. So, like, but that is changing. I do think that people are, there is more of a culture now trying to access different sort of conversations and different talent for its own sake, you know, not because they think, oh, that's what the demographic wants. And I think that's a really good step.
I'm hopeful.
But I do also think, a part of me goes... It would be lovely to see the sort of very different, diverse kinds of stories and people coming up through self-publishing, given more of a voice on those platforms. But then another part of me does go, well, why? Because if they're doing their own thing more successfully in their own way, you know, that somebody can, you know, I'm not this person, but someone who, say, comes from their own entirely different set of very un-BBC, very un-Radio 4 inspirations, and they set themselves up a successful show which runs for a long time and which is very becomes very popular and gets advert sponsoring or Patreon sponsorship or whatever, they can make a lot more money than they could make going through like 17 different drafts of writing a single one-hour Radio 4 play, you know. And like, I'm someone who, like, I really like a lot of Radio 4 drama and I really like a lot of Radio 4 comedy and I'd love to contribute to it. And I'm, as ever, trying, really, like constantly sending pitches out to different people in different mediums, you know. That's the life of... doing writing and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do sort of think there is also, I think there is an innate desire, especially where it comes to the BBC, to feel like you want like auntie's approval. You know, you want, you want the endorsement of the gatekeeper, and partly because, you know, they've got some money they can just give you, you know,
exactly.
you don't have to make, you can be given, you know, several thousand pounds all in one go just for writing something. You don't have to make that several thousand pounds over a course of 5 years while producing loads of material and, you know, gathering contacts and marketing your show. But a part of me goes, something that's occurred to me is, if you really, like, I really love Crowley Time. I like putting it, I love it if suddenly millions of people were listening to it. I'd absolutely adore that. But it is in its own way deliberately a niche thing, so I can easily see that not happening. I feel really lucky to have the extremely loyal following I already have. It's a blessing. And it did occur to me that, like, I think I'm too creatively restless to just focus on the one thing for the rest of my life. But a part of me did go, if, let's say, I wasn't getting any, you know, more work in performing or writing professionally for any sort of broadcaster or whatever, and let's say that the only thing that did take off was Crowley Time, the benefit of that, you know, it'd be an awful lot of work to try and maintain it to the standard where people would remain interested, but it would be a success completely of my own making. Like, it would be an audience that I have myself gathered, and it would be money that has been sent solely to me to create my own thing. And I think that's the sort of thing that creates, you know, maniacs like Joe Rogan. Like, you know, when you found your own cult of people that will happily sponsor your life in full for the rest of your life, you know, you probably go insane. But anyway, it's a strange thing. I think that I agree with you. I think that you need. I think the biggest problem facing like British broadcasting in every form is a total lack of access for new talent and a lack of curiosity on the part of people who are making the commissioning. You know, I'm not even talking about myself here. I think, you know, there's plenty of me. There's plenty of 30-something straight white guys getting opportunities. But when it comes to the conversation about like diversity or, you know, even diversity in terms of like class, the problem is there aren't enough people whose job it is to find the new people. And when there's no one there who's, you know, being paid a full-time wage to investigate, scout and find the new people, you end up with the same old people who are dependable and, you know, they know they can rely on. And it's as simple as that. And I think that will remain the problem. For all the sort of brave words about, you know, wanting to feature more, you know, new and innovative and diverse talent, it's like, yeah, I'm sure you would like to do that. You will, however, just be giving the same opportunities, the same tiny cabal of people, unless you make it your priority to find new talent. And I think that this obviously is the worst time in history for that because we've got a pandemic and no one can make anything. But that said, I think that, you know, when that's no longer the case, I think there isn't a focus on it. There isn't a focus on bringing in new voices. And that is understandable because the whole job of people in positions of commissioning power is find stuff that people like, and then if you can find the things that people like, milk them until they are long dead, because we need to dependably bring in viewers, sponsorship money, approval ratings. You know, like we need to show that we are making good things, because everyone's job is under threat. But if I just feel like if there were, I feel like there's a very obvious like silver bullet for any sort of new talent search, whether that just be new people for the sake of new people, or training up new people, or training up people who have less access to the industry, either because of location, class, race, whatever it is. Just create a position where it's someone's job to find these people with promise, and then introduce them to the people to know. No, it wouldn't, because especially with the internet, everyone's self-publishing, and there's a million different avenues you can go down to find the best people doing a certain thing.
Absolutely. I think, like, because I remember when the plans to put Purgatory to Radio 4, which was kind of like the first kind of instance, I had this back and forth with the commissioning department, where there was like, well, you've got to fill out these 18 forms, and then you need to pay this money to register yourself as a business, and then you've got to do this and this, and then you'll be put on the group of people that might get listened to. And I was like, well, we've made it. Can just someone from your end listen to a couple of minutes from it and think if it's appropriate or not?
No, that's interesting as well. Yeah, it's interesting to try and register yourself as the supplier as well.
Absolutely.
It's hard enough to get someone to read a script, but then to be registered as a professional production company is a whole different challenge as well.
But then saying, I think I'm hopeful with like the strides we've made with technology, making microphones, quality microphones, a lot cheaper. Production software, a lot cheaper. There's a lot more shareware stuff. There's like freesounds.org, which is a free peer-to-peer sound effects website where you just credit the person for it. Same goes in music. It's become easier to make, and and also got people like Wireless Theatre,
who are now absolutely concrete.
Like set down, and you know, and Wooden Overcoats as well. Like the work you guys did when everybody else was being like, make radio drama, but we can all congregate in a public space in close proximity. Why would we want to? And like you guys, you know, absolute foresight to. To make that instead.
I think it's the reason that Overcoats really came about is a good, it ties in well to what we're saying, which is like, so when you put on a play, as you know, we all had done at that time, you are at the behest of the theatre that allows you to put it on, the amount of money you have to rent that theatre that has programmed you in, people's diaries being available to attend every performance. And then if you want to tour it, you then need to find multiple venues to do that. If you want to move to a bigger venue in London, you're probably going to need to find some sponsorship because you can't afford to hire a theatre in Trafalgar Square, you know, to get to the next rung on the ladder. And even then, it's incredibly hard to be even considered for that. A lot of the time, it was the opposing force of those obstacles and those challenges, which just made, you know, if one person kind of went, I'm not sure I can be bothered with this, then that was the project dead because you needed everyone pushing together. And I think that the possibilities that were offered by a lot of people, I think that we wanted to do Overcoats on Radio 4 and were rejected, but that's not true. We never sent it to them. We had a long history of like inspiration from Radio 4 when we started putting the project together, but we never gave it to them, and we never wanted them to make it for us or anything like that. We went into this expecting to make it ourselves, because like in the post serial and similar kind of landscape, suddenly the idea of doing podcasting seemed like a big possibility. It seemed like you could find an amazing reach in it, and I would deign to say we have, like I would dare to say rather, that we have found a pretty huge following for who we are, which is just some people, but you know, with no corporate sponsorship or, you know, publicity machine behind us, and it was just the sense that you can make it, put it out, and then it's there forever. Like, you don't need to reassemble the cast. We do for live shows and things, but that's optional. You know, the main event, the show itself that's been edited and put together, that is there forever. And if we want to tell new people about the show, we don't have to book out the at Leicester Square Theatre or whatever, you know, for another performance so that they can see it. All we do is send them a link, and it's like, there it is. It's fully formed. This is the form it was always intended to take. It is. We consider it finished and, you know, as good as it can be. There you go. And that's the, you know, and I think that coming out of like a live performance background, that sense of liberation is sensational. But that said, I think it'd also be wrong if I if I said that I didn't love doing the live performances that we do, and also that I do also love putting on shows. So
having an audience and kind of and having that real, especially if you kind of like in like the comedy sitcom or just comedy in general, to have that really nice real time feedback. Of like, this is work, this is you know, made people laugh, and we, you know, it's almost empirical, it's, you can't really debate the fact of whether something was funny or not because you had laughter. I imagine for the future, because I saw with the band the Dresden Dolls,
yeah,
Lady on Amanda something,
Amanda Palmer,
where she, I think she left her recording company, just went, I'm just going to use Kickstarter to do tours, to do albums. The fans are going to become the investors, and we're going to take out everybody else's kind of role in it. And I don't know, I've got a feeling that might be where, because I know that's what Wooden Overcoats did, I think, for season two, that you went to Kickstarter to, and they kind of explained how many people were involved in making it and how the audience kind of behaved for their time. And I know maybe 4 or 5 months down the line from now for Purgatory, we'll probably, I mean, depending on whether like we'll have an audience big enough to warrant doing that. But at that point, I think we'll be saying like, because I have been more than lucky to have a professional cast give all their time in kind. Otherwise, the whole thing just wouldn't have happened.
Well, I mean, that's how we started, though. I mean, we started on favours, and, you know, we had to raise, between about seven of us at the core of the team, we had to raise £2,000. And, you know, that's a lot of money, but not between six, seven people. You know, suddenly it becomes manageable. And so we all threw in for that. And most of that was hiring the studio, and the rest of it was travel and food. And so we raised a little bit of seed money just to do that. And then we managed to make that back through doing our live performances. That's why we started doing live shows, was as fundraisers to pay us all back for the money we'd spent. And we just, you know, we pushed it hard enough and we found enough of a following that we thought it wouldn't be mad if we asked people for money to do this. And also we then knew we had a revenue stream in the live shows.
Yeah.
So we sort of put what we expected to make again through the live shows into a budget spreadsheet and then added the amount we would need on top of that to pay everybody to the tune that we thought was achievable. And then launched a Kickstarter, and you know, the most recent one we did smashed through our goal in like a day. I'm burping again in the morning. Oh, it's the nerves of thinking about all that money. No, but the latest one we did was an immediate thing. And I think that's because people understood they knew they could trust us to actually make the show, although we haven't yet because of the Rona. But, you know, it's coming, promise. But, but the first one we did, it was more touch and go just because, like, we were a smaller concern then. We'd only made the one series and, you know, we were watching it tick up gradually. And I remember about halfway through the campaign time, we were halfway to our target and thinking, well, that seems correct, but we just, you know, if we make £1 too little, we're not going to make it, you know. But in the end, luckily, we just tipped over. And it was just the wonderful feeling. I still remember the first time I went as a paid actor to do a recording of Wooden Overcoats and thinking to myself, oh my God, this is a job. Like, I'm doing a job now. This isn't just me doing this thing that I love doing with people who I love, working with scripts that I love. You know, this is a job now. It's not the highest paid job. Well, it wasn't then. the highest paid job in the world. But it's like, it is a job. I am being paid to be here. It's just that little change. So again, I think, you know, obviously it does take an awful lot of work in terms of getting the word out about the show and finding the people who are going to reconnect with what you're doing. Obviously, I'd also say don't be afraid to really lean on friends and family the first time you do a fundraiser. That certainly helped us out a lot when we did Wooden Overcoat Series 2. You know, because the bigger following who'll give you money spontaneously, that will follow probably later. But if you can just get like a fundraiser together, if you can get 100 people to give you a tenner each, suddenly you've got some money. And then you're going, what can I use this money for? And you suddenly it becomes a professional concern. I mean, I've got a Patreon on Crowley Time and I get paid just under £100 a month at this point. That'll probably have changed by the time this goes out, up or down. But, you know, that's not a secret either. That's been publicly listed on the Patreon before, which, you know, compared to how much effort and time it takes to make one of those things is absolutely a pittance. But it's the fact that it is a reward that I am getting for producing this thing that I want to make. It turns it into something else. And that is, I think, that is... Of course, it's all about the love of what you're making, and it's and a big part of it is doing it for the passion of it. But the fact that there are now ways that you can take a passion project like that and make it a going professional concern is really emancipating, I think. And I think, yeah, as you say, I think we'll see a lot more of people finding direct ways to do that. I think that giving more creative people not just the access to creating work, but also the access to monetizing it, I think that's going to see a huge improvement in the kind of the diversity of voices that we're seeing promoted. And I think it's going to have a big impact on the way that the broadcast media thinks about what they're putting out. And also, I think it's going to just create a world of its own of people making their own thing and earning their living from it. And I think that's going to democratize creativity a lot the world over.
The revolution is coming. Well, thank you so much.
It will be televised on my YouTube channel.
Thank you so much, Tom, for,
no, pleasure.
For
thank
coming
you.
On and taking so long to talk to me as well.
That's been a joy.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And maybe down the line we might do this again.
That would be lovely.
My little plan is to build a little community of people like yourself who make and produce this, so we can start sort of talking to each other and trying to grow this as a whole. But thank you very much again. So I will just plug you for one more time. So Tom Crowley, you can find him on Wooden Overcoats, which is on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all other affiliated websites, on Crowley Time for the same as well on Spotify and podcasts. And he's got his course on the London, is it London City Academy?
City Academy. If you go to bit.ly/begin podcasting, that should, I think, link to all of the upcoming courses.
Magical. And follow him on Twitter, on Facebook. He's got accounts in both. And if you're a director, cast him immediately.
Absolutely.
Yes, write please. The film after the fact. Just cast him first and then build from there.
I'll just improvise it on the fly as I say, I should do that more often. Well, we'll improvise the film together, then you can release it and become rich.
It'll be super. Tom and Francis in the Woods. That's not a good title. On that note.
Slasher thriller. Anyway, on that note, goodbye, Francis, and thank you so much for having
me. Take care. Thank you for being on.